Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Susanna Galswick. Susanna is a clinical psychologist and family therapist and Ireland's first certified eating disorder specialist and consultant. With over a decade of experience, Susanna is dedicated to supporting individuals and families on their journey to recovery, focusing on physical healing, body image and family connections. As the IAEDP Chapter Chair of Ireland and Clinical Lead at a residential eating disorder treatment centre, Susanna also teaches, consults and supervises other therapists, sharing her expertise to advance the understanding of eating disorders. This week, we have a really interesting conversation about the use of GLP-1 medications and how this can implicate treatment for eating disorders. We take a really broad view of this and appreciate the fact that for some people, the GLP-1 medications may be supportive and may be useful. However, there really is a deeper understanding required for clinicians and healthcare professionals who are helping people with eating disorders. Well, thank you so much for joining me. It is so lovely to have you on the podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm really good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no worries. It's so funny because I feel like I know you already, but we've not actually met. But I think because obviously I've done work with Deirdre and I've been to your webinars, like, yeah, I absolutely know you. We've spoken before.
Yeah, I feel the same. The eating disorder field, I think, is quite small. After a while, you know, people, and at least you've heard of them or you've been at their trainings and things like that.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, I always find it funny when, you know, you're like, go to a conference or something, and then you find out you've got a mutual connection with someone. You're like, oh my God, the world is so small. You're like, well, no, actually, the eating disorder world is pretty small.
Yeah.
Oh, amazing. So did you want to introduce yourself for the listeners?
Yeah. So my name is Susanna Gajowiec, and I'm a clinical psychologist, family therapist, and certified eating disorder specialist. So I live in Ireland for 20 years, although I'm originally from Poland, and I'm also chair of the International Association of Eating Disorder Professionals. So I, apart from my clinical work, and I'm in the field of eating disorders for nearly 12 years now, I try to be as active as possible in teaching, consulting, and supervising therapists. And I'm co-founder of Supported Families, where I try to do that together with Deirdre that you mentioned earlier. And we also support families and individuals in the recovery from eating disorders.
Wow. You do a lot then.
That's a short version.
Yeah, you absolutely cover everything. That sounds absolutely amazing. And it's honestly such a pleasure to be able to speak to you today and have you on the podcast. So we are going to speak about GLP-1 medications, which I think is a very hot topic at the moment. And I think with this time of year as well, it is particularly a hot topic because, you know, I think there's a lot of conversations around it in terms of, you know, generally in society, particularly people with eating disorders and the impact that it's having, but also with everyone seems having a weight loss near its resolution. I think it's a great time to talk about it. So I guess to start with, do you mind sort of giving us maybe like a bit of a scientific overview of the medications and how they work?
Yes, but before I start, I just want to mention that I think we're not going to cover everything for sure. It's a kind of wide topic and there's so many different aspects, so hopefully we can share maybe some articles as well in the notes so that if people want to learn more they can because it's going to be really hard to cover everything. So the GLP-1s are glucagon-like peptides. They belong to a class of molecules that we refer to as incretins. So these molecules stimulate insulin release after we eat food, and they have ability to decrease blood sugar levels. That's why they work so well with type 2 diabetes, which they were originally invented for or approved for. So they are secreted in the cells in our small intestine and in colon, although the receptors are found in all the different organs around the body, which is really important because when we talk about different side effects or different influence that those medications can have on different organs and different body parts, I think it's important to note. So we have receptors in the heart, in the stomach, in the pancreas, liver, even in muscles and in the brain. And I think that connection with the brain is really important for the conversations we're going to have about the eating disorder population. There's, again, a lot to say. So I think what's important is to kind of maybe understand how they work, because they've been called the miracle weight loss drugs. You know, we hear a lot of different things, but, you know, they're not actually, they don't possess some magical ability to just decrease the fat cells in our body, or, you know, they primarily work by actually decreasing our appetite. Therefore, the other kind of effects are slow gastric emptying. So, or in the brain, they affect the appetite regulating neural pathways. So they can decrease maybe desire in food or increase satiety and reduce food intake in that way. So they basically just kind of work, or the weight loss is achieved by not eating enough or not being interested in food, therefore not eating enough. And I think this is important, again, in our conversations about eating disorder populations. Again, as I said earlier, they were developed to treat type 2 diabetes, and it was just accidentally discovered that in some, again, in some individuals, not for everyone, they had as a side effect weight loss. And again, this is a big question. Is the weight loss actually a side effect, or should it be celebrated? Should it be considered a gain? And in our weight obsessed, I guess, culture, again, it's kind of no brainer that it's celebrated and it's viewed as a gain rather than a side effect. But we can come back to this conversation later. So again, they were initially developed for type 2 diabetes, and they work very, very well for that population. I think, again, what's really important to note is that there are very different dosage for people who use it for type 2 diabetes, and the dosage for people who are trying to achieve weight loss are very different. So we typically would use much higher doses of the medication, or also the medication sometimes are combined together, which again will have different effects, and the side effects could be more severe because there's a bit more of that, those medications kind of coming into our body. And because of that, of course, eating disorder professionals, and I think increasingly also people who have nothing to do with eating disorders, even doctors who just prescribe this medication for weight loss, are increasingly more worried that they actually can increase the development of eating disorder behaviors, or that they can trigger eating disorder behaviors. Again, it makes sense if we think about just the way, a very well-known fact in our field, that dieting is often, for many, many people, actually the trigger for eating disorders. So people can have maybe disorder eating or some other issues, but actually the moment when they start to diet, the moment when the body experiences starvation, is the moment when the eating disorder becomes very established, or, and those pathways in the brain kind of work very differently. I think it's also maybe a little good to look at the maybe history of how this medication kind of was developed. So as I mentioned, they were kind of quite long on the market. The first GLPs were approved in 2005, so it's 20 years now, again, for the type 2 diabetes, and they work very well. So we have a lot of research on, and we know they're quite safe, and they work very well, or the side effects are much less than the benefits of them. But we have to realize that I think since there was a shift to use those medications more for weight loss, we have loads more new labels, and those new labels have limited research, and they quite new on the market. So some of them we actually have very little research or no research on. And it just exploded. It's absolutely a marketing phenomenon that, like no other. And I think, again, this is worth maybe investigating a bit more. And yeah, there's some ethical and other issues connected to that. So I guess maybe last thing as the introduction, I guess maybe it's good to say what we are talking about. So we're talking about medications like Ozempic, Wegovy, Mounjaro, Zepbound, just to mention a few. I'm sure people have heard those names.
Yeah. It's I feel like it's that name that when you hear it, you're like,
yeah,
okay, here we go. And it's very interesting for me to actually have this discussion with you, because it's something that I've not actually spoken about on the podcast. But I think most people will be aware that, like, you know, 9 months or so ago, I did quit my job and I went self-employed. And the reason why I went self-employed was because the company I was working for originally was a digital health tech company, and then they changed the business completely to sell Ozempic and Wegovy. And I think the difficulty I see is that there's a really fine line. And as you said, you know, there's lots of research for people with diabetes and it has been really supportive. And I guess it's a similar vein to ketogenic diet and epilepsy and, you know, fasting and, you know, potentially health conditions that can be supported there. But it's once again where we've taken something that is a medical, whether it's a medication or a, you know, a treatment process, and because of weight loss and our obsession with weight loss, that's been the main focus. And I think that was one of the biggest things for me, was not only the impact that that's having on people with disordered eating disorders, difficult relationships with their body, but also people with type 2 diabetes that are relying on this medication that then can't have access to it because it is being sold as a weight loss drug. And like you said, it's this magical miracle, like wonder drug type thing. And I think for me, where I sit with it, and particularly what you were talking about, you know, when people are subject to dieting behaviors and then that puts them at risk of having an eating disorder, I think one of the things that I really worry about, and this was one of the biggest reasons why I left my job, was people take the medication, they lose weight very quickly, potentially, as you know, very well mentioned, it doesn't work for everybody. So I think my biggest issue is, okay, you found this drug that is a wonder drug, a miracle drug, like it's absolutely magical. This will answer, you know, all those diets you've been on and it's never worked. This will work for you. Well, okay, then it doesn't work, let's say. And all of those people, you know, the difficulty with mental thoughts and things like that they're going to have. But then equally, the people that it does work for, they lose all the weight, they get all the compliments, all the comments of how amazing they look, now they've lost weight, they're always here in society. And then they come off them and then they put the weight back on. And the kind of mental health impact of that, I don't even think that you can put into words, because it's literally just amplifying. Maybe when you have an eating disorder, it's almost a slower process of losing weight, but you experience that same kind of societal praise and stuff. And then the weight just completely rebounds. It's quite scary.
Yeah, exactly. I think if we were living in a society that was more kind of weight neutral, then we wouldn't have the same effect. So maybe that would be more considered a side effect rather than something really to especially kind of monetize so quickly. But I think the problem is that we live in a very weight biased society. So any weight loss is celebrated because we still sadly view higher weight bodies as kind of wrong bodies that need to be, you know, smaller at any cost, even if the, like you said, even if the cost is actually creating something much more complicated or much worse for people, like mental health issues or eating disorders or other complications. So yeah, it is quite problematic here. And especially it's very interesting how quickly those medications were presented, particularly because I think we still really don't know much about them. We still need a lot of research, but they present it as a miracle drug, or they present it as something that's absolutely safe because they're on the market for so long. Yes, they're on the market for long, but for diabetes, not for weight loss. And as I said, the dosage is different. The combination of drugs that are used are different. So there's a lot of stuff that we still don't know, yet it's presented as an amazing thing that works very well for everyone, which is not true as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I guess in that vein, I know you said that there's not a lot of research in the way that the dosage is being used, but have there been any like common, maybe like health risks or side effects that have been seen when people have been taking these drugs? Because I mean, I've seen on the news, you know, in the most severe cases, people have died. And I think that to me shows how obsessed as a society we are that people are dying because people are still continuing to take the drugs.
So yeah, the most common side effects are, again, depending on how severe they are, but, you know, not that worrying, like nausea, abdominal pain, vomiting, diarrhea, constipation. Again, the problem with that is that they often actually lead to people not being able to eat. That's partially the reason why people are eating very little or losing so much weight, because they're just not able to eat normally, not that able to eat regularly. But then, yeah, like you said, there's less common, but actually very serious side effects that are not spoken about so much that are really quite severe. So again, we don't have enough research on that. Some of those studies are actually done on rodents, not humans, but it's quite worrying what the less common, but more serious side effects could be like. So like kidney injury, suicidal behavior ideation, gallbladder disease, pancreatitis, yeah, just to mention a few.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you list them, side effects, it's actually quite scary the impact that they have. And I don't think that I was aware of the fact that the dosage is actually, you know, much higher than someone with type 2 diabetes, because I think a lot of people have been saying, oh, well, you know, they must be safe because we use them for type 2 diabetes. But actually, you know, the way that they're being used is completely different and maybe not kind of aligning with the research that we have and you know, the impact that we know that to have as well.
Again, the focus, because if you have a type 2 diabetes, the focus is on regulating your blood sugar levels. So when you maybe lose weight at the beginning, and then, as you said, kind of plateaus, or maybe the weight loss stops, people are not panicking because they're using it to regulate their glucose levels. So, you know, whereas if we use it for weight loss, actually, when people get to that stage, either that it doesn't work so well for them, or maybe that it actually plateaus, or they start to regain the weight, you know, what's happening then is panic, or is wanting to have the same effect. Therefore, people are prescribed higher doses, or some medications are combined, which we don't actually know anything about that, how that's, we have no studies on combining those medications together. So yeah, it's very worrying when we just shift the focus to weight loss, and the weight loss is the most important thing for us.
Just a question. Can you get these medications prescribed, like, let's say, from your doctor, or do you have to buy them privately? Because surely if we don't have, like, research behind the dosage and combining different medications, surely that's not approved under NICE guidelines.
Yeah, so there's actually a big problem with the appropriate and inappropriate usage of those medications. So at the moment, even though we have limited evidence and limited research, they are approved for diabetes type 2, obesity, even though, of course, there's a problem with that word and that it's not defined in a very scientific way. So I always use obesity with inverted commas because, you know, it's based on BMI, and BMI is not a measure of health, is a statistical measure. So there's a lot of problems with obesity, which we're going to add to the notes, actually a reference to Reagan Chastain research or her commentary on that, because I think it's important to know. So yeah, so they approved for diabetes, obesity, excess weight, and weight-related medical problems. All those terms are quite loose, but even with that, and they should not be approved for eating disorders. They're not medication to treat eating disorders, and they also kind of counterindicated for people with eating disorders, although, of course, sometimes people with maybe type 2 diabetes are going to use that, and we shouldn't exclude them from eating disorder treatment. But there's a lot of inappropriate use of those medications. And again, this is another ethical issue, that a lot of the companies actually buy telehealth companies, so that it's very easy for people to be prescribed those medications. So it's actually apparently very easy. You can actually just meet a pharmacist or maybe a GP online, and, you know, like, there's not much screening or not much happening in terms of maybe just making sure that this is appropriate for you, and you can get those medications. But even with people who are actually going to the doctor and even following the more traditional kind of pathway, there's a lot of problems, because a lot of people who are living in higher weight actually are not even screened for eating disorders. Mm-hmm. We have this bias that eating disorders only affect, you know, very skinny and young people. So there's a lot of populations that doctors wouldn't be curious about any of those behaviors. And a lot of people with binge eating disorders are actually not diagnosed with binge eating disorders. They still treated for obesity, or, you know, the weight loss is the main focus. So yeah, there's a lot of populations that could be missed, even if there is a proper screen, or not screening, but if they go through the proper path. But there's also a kind of, you can say, black market, or, you know, other ways that people acquire those medications that is really worrying.
Yeah. When I worked at my old job, I was in the marketing team, which is why I left my job, because I was like, I do not want to be creating marketing materials for this. But as part of my role, I had to obviously look at our competitors and, you know, look at how, like, the logistics of getting the drugs and stuff like that. Because my, I guess, the way that I made it sort of tried to make it morally okay for myself, because I was tied into this job, was to develop a behavioral change program that went alongside the drug, so that you had to participate in that, so that you could learn healthy behaviors, so that, you know, when it came to the point where you needed to then come off the drugs, you wouldn't just regain all that weight and then maybe face with those mental health challenges because of that, because you'd learn how to lead a healthy lifestyle. And when I looked and did the market research, there was a particular supermarket that literally the only thing that prevented me from actually buying the drugs, putting my credit card details in. And this was at a point where I was very unwell with anorexia. And I'm not saying that I was trying to buy the medication, but I just lied about everything. You know, I didn't even have to go onto a video call, show my weight or anything like that. I just typed in all the numbers, and it was, you know, within 5 minutes, there was the medication accessible to me. And I think that's what terrified me, was when you're working with people with eating disorders, and I think generally just, you know, people that are struggling with their body image in general and want to do something about it, they're a very vulnerable population. And actually, I think people would, you know, whatever the cost, people will put their money forwards in order to lose weight if they think that that's something that's accessible to them.
Yeah, that there's a lot of ethical issues surrounding that. So I think even if we are eating disorder professionals like me, and we have no desire to promote that, or even, again, research at the moment is telling us not to recommend that for any eating disorder, any eating disorder behaviors, we still are going to face those clients. People might be taking them and might not even tell us about them. So we really need to be prepared. We really need to know a lot about them so that we can even screen ourselves or ask appropriate questions, because they just become more and more popular and also so easy to buy, like you said. So I think we have to learn more, and we have to know more and more about them.
Absolutely. And I guess for healthcare professionals, you know, or it's more specifically eating disorder professionals like yourself, how would you say, like, through your experience and understanding of these drugs, how they would implicate somebody's eating disorder treatment?
So again, maybe I'll start with the current kind of guidelines for us eating disorder professionals. So we have a really brilliant article, and hopefully we're going to share that. It's in the International Journal of Eating Disorders. It's from December 2023, so not so old. And I'm just going to quote that. Currently, no GLP have been approved for the treatment of any eating disorder symptoms. And even though we have limited research, we have enough to be cautious and think that they could cause, maintain, or worsen eating disorder symptoms. So I guess, and also in this document, actually, there's a very good guide for clinicians, and even with the weight that we can talk to the clients that we work with, or the patients we work with. So it's a very good document. So I think anyone who is an eating disorder professional should really familiarize themselves with that. So I guess, again, if someone is, I think we always first have to start with just kind of inquiring if the person is taking them appropriately or not. So if someone is taking them for other health reasons or all those things that it's approved for, we should not exclude people from the eating disorder treatment, of course. But we definitely have to talk about how this will impact their eating disorder treatment, because it kind of goes against what the treatment is like. You know, so if someone has actually any kind of eating disorder, we focus on regular eating, we focus on kind of enough nutrition, and like you said, learning to have a better relationship with food, better relationship with the body. Whereas those medications, even if that's not the main focus for the person, they can cause difficulties with that. They can cause actually prolonged kind of starvation or not eating enough, and which leads often to later binging. So yeah, just a lot of conversations. I think we have to take kind of the harm reduction approach with clients who are already taking those medications, or try to educate them and help them to maybe make better decisions. Because sometimes, again, like you said, it's just because this is why this is such an ethical issue, because it's how it's presented. I think if people, not many people, like read research or study side effects, or study carefully what and they, you know, they would believe in the marketing. And they would believe, especially if it's endorsed by celebrities and it's talked about all the time, or particularly, I think, when it comes from their doctors as well, that I think now the doctors also start to talk about this and present it as a wonderful weight loss drug. So I think we have to do a lot of educating And like, but first we have to be educated. We have to know the research, but also know how to read research, because some of the research that's out there also is a bit problematic, that the sample is very small, or they were not very diverse. Maybe the subjects were not very diverse, or that, you know, even just the way that they interpreted the research isn't as accurate. So it is really quite challenging territory for us eating disorder professionals. That's why I think we need to really learn as much as we can. And it's also dynamic. I think things are changing. So God knows what will happen. Maybe we'll learn more positive things about, but at the moment it is not recommended for eating disorders. It's not something that helps. I think there is a misconception that it should be used for binge eating disorder. And sometimes, sadly, it's often even prescribed for binge eating disorder. Again, we don't have enough data to support that. And I think people who used it for binge eating disorder, they report that, again, because of this impact on the brain, that at first they did experience some like relief from the brain, the food noise, the kind of obsessional side of the binge eating. And they started to lose weight. And of course, that was celebrated by others and was very welcomed by them. But then both the weight gain and also the food noise came back with the vengeance. And again, it makes sense. I think this is what our bodies is very good at. It's very good at keeping us alive and preventing us from starving to death. So we don't know exactly what happens. But, you know, it is possible that the body just kind of tries harder to make sure that we are still aware that we're starving, and kind of all this attention to food comes back. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's kind of similar mechanism to, you know, when people just not eating enough and kind of it triggers a starvation mode, that the body and the brain just tries to save them from starvation. We don't know this, but at the moment I think we have to go with what the recommendations are for us eating disorder professionals. Again, it's very tricky. I think when we have people that even take it inappropriately, we can still help them. We can educate and take the harm reduction model, which is still not abandoning our clients, but also really trying to make sure that they make better and more informed decisions. But it is quite tough.
Yeah, I think a lot of it, in my opinion, comes down to your instinct. And, you know, if instinctively you're thinking, actually, I don't think that this person, you know, this is suitable, you mm-hmm. know, the guidance yeah. is obviously there to help sure. you with that. But, you know, yeah. I think as medical professionals, we mm-hmm. you can yeah. have that sort of knowledge. And I think I find it really difficult because, and you know, this may be a controversial opinion, I don't know, but I mean, we touched a little bit on GLP-1 medications in last week's podcast, and Sam, who was on the podcast, he said that actually, so he's a PT, and he said that he had a client and they weren't able to engage in exercise because of the weight that they were at. And so they were on the GLP medications to assist them with the initial weight loss to get them to a place where they could move and, you know, they would be able to engage in that physical activity for their health. And so I think in that way, I think that they can be supportive. And I know I've got, you know, people in my life that have really struggled with being overweight and, you know, being told by their doctor that they're very unhealthy, and then having the medications as almost a way of initiating mm-hmm. their weight loss because they haven't been able to do it themselves, getting to a place where they then feel that they can go and exercise or they can eat better and things like that. And I think it's like I was saying before in terms of improving those lifestyle behaviors. However, I think that's like the general populace, let's say. When you then look at people with eating disorders, it is a completely different kettle of fish. And, you know, particularly with, you know, something like binge eating disorder, I think the big issue there is that it's very much, it almost feels like you're trying to apply a plaster to kind of deal with the emotions around food and body and everything like that. But we all know that when you use medication in that sense, you've got to take that plaster off at some point. And actually, you know, all of those behaviors and things you've just been suppressing. And then if you rip the plaster off, well, you know, it's like when you rip a scab off when you're a kid or whatever, and it almost makes it so much worse. So I think in that sense, it's so difficult to navigate in terms of, you know, maybe it being potentially supportive for people without an eating disorder, but then for people with an eating disorder, literally making things a thousand times worse. And I guess, like you've said, a lot of the time, I guess potentially the people that are more likely to take these medications are going to be people that aren't necessarily diagnosed, you know, whether that is with OSFED, with binge eating disorder, you know, all these different types of things. And one thing I wanted to ask you, actually, which popped into my head is, have we kind of reached any clarification or anything like that in terms of, obviously, one of the diagnostic criteria for bulimia is a misuse of medication. So would this fall under that, or is that something that's not really even been discussed yet?
I've never came across, it's not recommended for diabulimia or bulimia, but no, I never came across this we definitely sometimes think of that, maybe from that angle, we sometimes have to think of the use of this medication as yet another eating sort of behavior if it's used for as a compensatory behavior. So I guess in our maybe formulating the problem or in trying to understand what's happening, I think we sometimes definitely look at it from that perspective. But going back to what you were saying before, I think I was a bit more dogmatic maybe at the beginning and more black and white. I think it is really important because people are going to make those decisions anyway. And I have a lot of empathy for people making those decisions, even if it's not the best choice or even with the current knowledge. I would just like people to be very well educated to really make informed decision, because I'm worried that at the moment people are not making informed decisions. I think at the moment it's presented in a way that can be misleading. And even if someone makes an informed decision, and it's still their decision, they have the right to make choices for their bodies that they make. And that's why I really like the harm reduction approach, that there's always so much good that we can do with the person working with them. We can even if someone actually is struggling to maybe connect with their body or connect with their appetite and maybe read their body as they take those medications, actually still having those conversations, still trying to work on that, teaching them more connection to the body. And again, like you said, because eventually they are going to come off of this or it's going to stop working so well for them. So people are still going to need to face the same issues. So I think either for therapists like me or dietitians, I think we still have a lot of important work, the same kind of work that we're doing anyway in eating disorder recovery, I guess just maybe first making sure that people really are aware of all the scientific, limited but kind of scientific data that we have and that I make informed decision. But yeah, I'm really of the opinion that we still have so much to do, either as therapists or dietitians, and we can still do so much good, even if people are taking those medications that are not appropriately used. And we shouldn't judge anyone, because I think it's so hard in our culture. I think our culture is actually prescribing that as a solution, that so many people are so desperate to just be more accepted, or just even, like you said, even some, it's very common actually that people in kind of higher weight bodies would feel too intimidated to even start moving their bodies a bit more, that they feel like they don't belong to the gym or they don't belong in certain places because they don't look like they belong, or, you know, it's very complex. It's actually kind of touching the social justice issues here a lot, which we're not talking about enough as well, because it's just presented as this kind of solution to a problem. But the problem, actually, the roots of the problem are so much more complex. Even with so-called obesity, you know, we are, I think, confusing a correlation with causation. So a lot of the health issues that are related to higher weight are actually kind of correlating, but we have still no proof or no kind of scientific data that one is causing the other or the other is causing. And also we have a lot of suspicion that maybe what's causing all those health issues in higher weight people is that they actually live in this oppressive culture that makes them feel that they are wrong, that their bodies are wrong all the time. Again, we know what are the psychological effects of other oppression. So, for example, I think it's been measured how stressful it is, or how many even health complications people have if they are racially oppressed. So it probably could be similar. And also just the weight circulating that people are also often experiencing, because when people are in higher weight bodies, the dieting in whatever form is often pushed on them. So they actually have multiple experiences of the kind of weight cycling. And the weight cycling, we know, is very damaging to the body and can cause a lot of those physical issues. So yeah, again, it's so much broader, but somehow it's kind of just really reduced to, at least in marketing, like you said, it's kind of used in a very, the marketing, again, it's never a very ethical business, but particularly I think with those drugs is problematic and sometimes even perpetuates, I guess, even just the idea that we have a solution to obesity and everyone can and should have access to, you know, it's kind of promoting the weight stigma and kind of contributes to this idea that we all should look in a particular way, or that some bodies are good bodies and some bodies are bad bodies and they should be changed at any cost, even if there's no actual reason to change them, or even if the person doesn't even want their body to change.
Yeah, I think that you've knocked the nail on the head in terms of, you know, thinking about the impact of chronic stress like that in itself. You know, if you don't feel like you fit in, or you're constantly worried about your body and things like that, like that's going to cause health problems anyway. We know that, you know, chronic stress causes massive impacts to people. So, you know, I think, like you say, the correlation rather than the causation, we don't have enough evidence to say, you know, it's directly linked to weight. Actually the experiences that are people having. And I think you're so right about the marketing as well, because I've always thought this in terms of, it's something that I've massively been like trying to think about and, you know, bring up a solution. Because when a fitness influencer or someone comes on and says, you know, try my 30-day trial to get a shredded body or what have you, it's sexy, it's quick, you know, it's really appetizing, because you're like, oh, easy, like I'll do that, then I'll look great. And then when you hear someone else say, you know, rather than doing that quick fix, you know, you should come to therapy, you should talk about your emotions, you should unpack everything, because we all know that actually, like, your image issues with your body image is not really about your body, it's deeper rooted in your emotions and the way that you think. Well, I'm sorry, but I know which one is more attractive to me. Yes. Like, I've spent several years in therapy myself, and it's hard. It's really hard work to get underneath that, particularly in a society where no matter what work you do on yourself, there's still people parroting in your head, oh no, you should be skinny, like that would make you loads better. So I think that, you know, there's that difficulty in itself of it's actually so much more attractive to do almost the easy option. You know, as you said before, like, I'm not having any stigma towards people, because I completely understand why people would take that option. But it is an easier option than actually getting to the roots of, you know, why you struggle with body image, why you struggle with your relationship with food, you know, why does all of that have such a big impact on you? So I can completely understand why people are very attracted to these drugs. And especially, as you were saying before, you know, if your doctor's telling you to do it, then realistically, like, we all listen to our doctor because we trust them. But equally, when you're seeing celebrities on these drugs and they're talking about how much happier they are and how much their life has improved and things like that, it's very difficult to argue when, you know, with people when they're saying that. And then I almost think that sometimes, because we come at it from a mental health perspective and eating sort of perspective, when I talk about it, my guard is up slightly, because I'm like, oh, I want to talk about this in a way that's actually really serious and I want to protect you. And they're like, yeah, but Sharon Osbourne, she's lost loads of weight and she looks great now. And you're like, how do I compete with that?
So I think sometimes it helps to maybe know about certain manipulations that those industries are using, and just educating people on that. But also I think it's the coming from the social justice issue. If we are living in a society that put so much pressure on people, then of course it's no brainer that we will kind of choose the easier option or the quickest option, because we're so desperate. We are feeling so horrible that we don't have time for, like, to think, oh, 5 years or 3 years of whatever treatments or therapies, or, you know, of course we are so suffering so much, but suffering because of the society that we live in, not so much suffering because of the bodies that we are living in. So yeah, this is a much bigger issue here that we're definitely not talking about enough.
Yeah, but thankfully we're doing this podcast, which means that there are more conversations having about it. And I think, like you said before, it is very nuanced, and actually you know, I think particularly in the eating sort of community, we are sensitive souls, and so we do have black and white thinking. And I think when something like this happens, we are almost like, you know, always, oh my god, this is absolutely awful. And you know, I think it does take some time to then be like, okay, yes, this is bad, but actually how can we work together to communicate this appropriately and actually think about some people that this may be supportive for and who it's not for. And I think that for me has been something throughout my whole eating disorder recovery is when something, I mean, this is slightly different because it's, you know, it does actually have health implications, but when something arises similar to this and I feel triggered by it, it's then really taking a step back and thinking, okay, why has that impacted me? And for me, it's because I've spent so many years trying to say to myself, I don't need to be in a smaller body, I'll be loved regardless. And then you've literally got everyone around you, drugs that are impacting their health, to be in smaller bodies. But yeah, I think that it's really important to have these conversations and to be open and to listen to the perspectives of, you know, all different types of people, because it's not kind of a one size fits all for everybody. And, you know, I think that in itself, if you just dismiss people that are maybe, you know, talk about it in a more positive light or talking about the impact it had on them, you kind of miss half the conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think there's a whole other population that maybe people that, again, the harm reduction approach really helps, because maybe someone, let's say, who has elderly parents and they kind of realize that they have to take care of their parents and just living in the body that they live in is just preventing them from being able to support or help their parent. Oh, that's just one example. You know, like it again, we have to look at health from much broader sense. So sometimes some of those choices, again, make sense. And, you know, in the kind of greater scheme of things, might be actually a good health choice, you know, even, but again, my I guess mission is that people are really aware and make informed choices, because I think the way it's presented now, it's really just not, you know, we're not talking about all the different aspects of what those medications are coming with, or even just the limitations in research and things like that. So, but yeah, of course, this is not black and white. And sometimes even with the side effects or even with the risks, this might be the right choice for, again, when we look at health in a much broader sense, could be the best option for someone, you know. So we can't really have this very kind of dogmatic or very black and white thinking as professionals, especially that our job is to support people and meet them where they are and really help them, not to contribute or to add to the stigma or to them feeling that they're doing something wrong and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's kind of my overarching thing about it is fundamentally concerning, but also let's keep an open mind to ensure that everybody is kept safe. So thank you so much for joining me. I don't know where that time went, but that just absolutely flew. So that was really lovely to chat to you. Where can people go to find out more about the work that you do and stay in contact with you?
Yeah, so you can find me at Supported Families for Psychology Hub.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much too.
Lovely way to do the first episode of the year.
Oh, lovely. I didn't realize it was the first one. Great. Thank you so much.
Amazing. If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.